Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And scene. Okay, that was great, everybody. Let's take five, and then we're going to take it right from the top. The Smollett and his mighty empire art players.
Yeah,
wow,
a lot of developments. Need a little more emotion, guys, when we do this the second time, okay? A
lot of developments yesterday, including, and I'm not talking about his Good Morning America interview, which we went over on yesterday's show.
And there's other things that we have to get to on that thing.
Two Chicago brothers of Nigerian descent who attended Lakeview High School, we should know, should assume they come from Lakeview.
Okay, we stop, but there's a huge contingency of Nigerians that live right there at Byron and Sheridan, okay?
Two Chicago brothers who attend Lakeview High School, potential persons of interest in the alleged attack on Jussie Smollett, detained by Chicago police at O'Hare on Wednesday. Police execute a search warrant on their home on Wednesday night, and at least one of them has appeared as an extra in Empire. That's the older brother. The younger brother's YouTube channel has various audition reels, including two mock police interrogations that were uploaded less than 2 weeks before Smollett's alleged attack. This is a CWB Chicago reporting. They've been doing a great job reporting on this case.
Oh, it's amazing. And did you see the door? They kicked in the door of their apartment there, and there's a list of things they took. You know, normal household items. They did take two bottles of bleach. They don't know if that's related to it. They took a red hat, tablets, laptops, some scarves, a wool coat, another laptop. They just listed all the items that they blogged in. I've been told that they're being held at 51st and Wentworth right now.
Now, police...
questioning them, and they also questioned Smollett last night.
Yeah, the police are saying the official line is that we're still treating Smollett as the victim.
Yeah.
But now the Chicago Press Corps, ABC, CBS, they all are, you know, citing multiple sources that suggest this was staged, that suggests some suggesting that these individuals could be charged, the two Nigerian brothers could be charged as soon as today.
Yeah, that's a possibility. And they did it all because supposedly Jussie Smollett was getting written off the show.
That's one.
So they wanted, one
potential motive.
Yeah, but then on the Twitter, I'm sorry, how old am I? The Twitter and the Instagram, on Twitter last night, the producers of Empire said, no, we weren't going to write him off the show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not buying that.
There's still this additional theory out there that was a fight between, I saw this circulating too, again, rumor, but a fight that was the result of Smollett, like, cheating on his boyfriend. And so there's the whole, like, personal romantic potential motive as well to stage this. We don't know. Most of the reporting seems to be what you said, Amy, which is that this was about trying to make it impossible to write him out of the show.
Yeah, so that, you know, the whole world would sympathize with him. And that's what happened on ABC's Good Morning America yesterday. Listen to the anchors. Real quick, I know we played his audio, but how they're just falling over this poor victim, this poor gay black man.
Jussie Smollett, he's answering questions about his story for the first time.
He really is, George, and the incident has sparked both an outpouring of support as well as questions about what happened that night on a cold Chicago street. Jussie was very passionate in his account, detailing the racist and homophobic words he says his attackers use, words that we cannot broadcast.
Oh, no. Simply, they're so... real and raw, and we can't broadcast them, Dan. We just simply can't. But then they did.
Well,
they
Here's the thing.
Great acting, Jussie. You should win an Emmy for that.
Well, and don't forget the brothers, if that's them. Remember, he said those two shadowy figures, the silhouettes caught on video, he thinks those were the attackers, and that's who the police have identified as the two Nigerian brothers.
And they picked him up after they got back from Nigeria.
Right.
So apparently they went to Nigeria after the staged event and then just got back.
So the interesting thing about this, it certainly explains how two men could pick Jussie Smollett out at 2 a.m. in the darkness across the street and say, hey, Empire guy, or whatever they allegedly
said. Yeah. Hey, Empire guy.
Right. So that starts to make a little more sense. Also this, just some background on the two brothers. A brother who appeared on Empire has no adult arrests in Chicago since 2014. The Tribune reports that he was charged with attempted murder in Cook County in 2011 pled down to aggravated battery. His brother was charged with DUI near their home in 2015 at the age of 21. No other adult arrests for the two, but those are significant adult arrests.
Also, they got the clothing line, they believe, at the Ace Hardware in Wrigleyville. And there's two there. I called one store in Southport. That's not the store. They don't sell clothing line, but the other one does. And he wouldn't confirm or deny if anyone there had come in recently and bought clothing line.
Now, you know, we got this call from another extra on Empire yesterday, lives in the West Loop. He was saying, you know, like he's interacted with Jussie Smollett and he's like been treated very well. And he thinks Jussie Smollett's a nice guy and so forth. So he's having a difficult time reconciling it. And I can understand that, too. He presents well, comes across well. Obviously, he's a successful actor, but he's a successful actor. And
does any believe he was acting yesterday? 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Well, would you say at this point, motivation, the alleged racial or anti-gay motivation, that doesn't seem to be holding up under scrutiny, does it? That this is the Trump country stuff? Yeah, or this MAGA country.
Well, listen to what he said yesterday about Trump.
That doesn't seem to be. So for those who rushed to rally for Jussie, I mean, this is like Covington all over again from a different perspective. For those who rushed to rally for him, the march in L.A., AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka standing with our in solidarity with our SAG-AFTRA brother and all of this other blather. Would you like to revise and extend your remarks at this juncture?
Oh, yeah. Kamala Harris, everybody.
Maxine Waters.
Yeah. Cory Booker. I mean, the list goes on and on. What he said during the interview is, I want a little gay boy who might watch this to see that I fought back. It does not take anything away from people who are not able to do that, but I fought back, then ran off. Okay.
Right.
But
he's the hero in the story that he wrote.
Yeah, and he won't say President Trump by name. By the way, refers to him as a number.
I come really, really hard against 45. I come really, really hard against his administration. And I don't hold my tongue.
Oh, okay. So he put him in the narrative. He put him in his plot scheme. Oh, and on the way out, yell, this is MAGA country. Okay, that's a good line. Who wants that line? Nigerian brother number one, or does Nigerian brother number two want that line?
Do you think Jussie Smollett's pilot will be picked up? Marty in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, I heard a different story. I heard the guys didn't yell, hey, Empire. I heard they yelled out, hey, 588-2300.
Okay. Very good. Thanks, Marty. A joke only a Chicagoan could love.
Yes.
Mike in Union.
Hey, just a little side thought. These two Nigerian brothers had to come back through immigration and customs. Did the local police, since we're a sanctuary city and state, did they use immigration to find out that these guys were back and that's how they detained them? I was just curious about that. We could find out, huh?
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mike. I don't know. Now, I don't know the legal status of the brothers. I don't know
that
that's
been
mentioned.
I think they're fine if they went through Lakeview High School and graduated from there. I mean,
You can't attend a school and be here illegally?
No, I don't know. They sounds like they've been here for a long time. Hmm. But they were picked up. I was told when they got back, they went to Nigeria for a few weeks, came through O'Hare Wednesday night, and they picked them up, and they were conducting the raid on their apartment on the north side in Wrigleyville at the same time.
Well, we will try to effort just to confirm their status, because in part it's relevant since both have been charged with serious crimes while they've been in Chicago, and they're not that old. I mean, again, the younger brother got the DUI in 2015 at the age of 21, so he's 24, 25, and the older brother doesn't look that much older.
Right.
It's a legitimate question.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, quick note since we're on Chicago mayor's race. You know, today's the 15th. The primary election is February 26th.
It's coming up soon, folks.
Less than 2 weeks away, mayoral candidate Willie Wilson yesterday held another one of his signature events, handing out tens of thousands of dollars to help people cover their property taxes with the first installments just arriving.
It just felt wrong. I mean, I know his heart's in the right place, but it just, the optics of it, it just seemed very strange.
Seems great to me. Well, love it. Absolutely.
But he's buying,
love
he said
it.
He's not buying votes because the money is not coming from his campaign. It's coming from his own foundation. And the people that they interviewed, oh my gosh, was one woman from Roseland who lost her job and she was practically in tears. I mean, he is doing God's work, but it just seems a little strange.
Yeah, I love
he's
it.
He's buying votes.
Yeah, not buying votes. Give me a break.
Well, you don't think those people are going to vote for him? If I took money from him, I would vote for him.
They should. So he's actually helping as opposed to, what, $5 to get and a ride to the polls, which is what the machine has been doing in the city for 100 years. I mean, get, you know, the
free
like the Pollyannish, like, oh, golly, oh, my goodness, this is so unseemly for Chicago politics. Give me a break. Not to mention Willie Wilson's generosity in this manner well predates his run for mayor. He's been doing it for a long, long time. And so I don't think you have to change who you are. In fact, you shouldn't change who you are when you run for office. So that's Willie Wilson. The other finalist for my support, Paul Vallis, released his first ad. It features money as well, but in a different kind of way.
There's nothing Chicago politicians fear more than this broom. I'm Paul Vallis, and I'll sweep out the money that has corrupted City Hall. I'll invest in schools, fighting crime, and creating jobs. I'm running for mayor to sweep out the Chicago machine and to invest in people and not corrupt politicians. I have the experience, the solutions, and the tools to do it. Join us in cleaning up City Hall for all Chicagoans.
It's like
they're sweeping them out and they're gonna hit the road, Jack.
Yeah,
it's like, I feel like I should do a routine.
I feel like it was a scene in like a Boardwalk Empire.
Did somebody say Empire?
800-588-2300 Empire
today.
Again, no word on whether Jussie Smollett's spinoff, Empire spinoff, has been picked up yet, but we'll let you know.
Coming up on
and Paul Vallis, you should see it. It's actually a pretty snappy ad,
oh,
and I like the broom visual. So that's
the metaphor of the broom, like, yeah, getting rid of all of them.
Vallis, the sweeper.
Good.
It's not bad. It's not bad. It's a pretty good ad. So we'll see.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
We have new information now also on the plane crash.
On AM 560.
Captain Sum Ting Wong, Wee Too Lo, Ho Lee Fook, and Bang Ding Ow.
The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And again, 9 a.m. this morning on these airwaves, you'll hear the president from the Rose Garden addressing his decision, apparently, to sign the border security funding deal that was reached, that was voted on yesterday, that has been sent to his desk, and also providing a bit of a zinger as Mitch McConnell announced to his Senate colleagues from the floor.
I've just had an opportunity to speak with President Trump, and he, I would say to all my colleagues, has indicated he's prepared to sign the bill. He will also be issuing a national emergency declaration at the same time. And I've indicated to him that I'm going to support the national emergency declaration. So for all of my colleagues, the president will sign the bill.
There you go. And the national emergency declaration, what do you think of the two-pronged response from the president to Congress? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. The president's decision to go ahead. All right, I'll link the compromise, but I'm also going to go ahead and declare the national emergency. I said I would multiple times over the last several weeks to round up some additional dollars for the kind of border barrier that I want to have completed by the 2020.
And he's going to take $3.5 billion from the Military Construction Fund, $2.5 billion from Pentagon Counter-Narcotics Funds, and $600 million from the Treasury Forfeiture Funds. That's what he's going to lay out today with his plan and then to build his wall.
And this shouldn't come as a surprise because, as Mick Mulvaney said the other weekend on Meet the Press, his chief of staff, the president has tasked us to look to find other available monies that are under executive discretion. And so they were at the ready. Nancy Pelosi had a bit of a different take than Mitch McConnell. And, of course, she talked about the dangerous precedent this is setting, which we'll address and take your responses to as well. What would a Democrat president do with this precedent that the president is on the cusp of setting?
Did I ever say I was filing a legal challenge?
You said Democrats.
I may. That's an option. And we'll review our options. But it's important to note that when the president declares this emergency, first of all, it's not an emergency. What's happening at the border? It's a humanitarian challenge to president that has tried to sell a bill of goods to America. But putting that aside, just in terms of the president making an end run around Congress, here he said, let us respect what the committee will do, and then walks away from it. But in any event, the president is doing an end run about Congress, about the power of the purse. You've heard me say over and over again, Article 1, the legislative branch, the power of the purse, the power to declare war, many other powers listed in the Constitution, and, of course, the responsibility to have oversight. So the president is doing an end run around that. We will review our options. We'll be prepared to respond appropriately to it. I know the Republicans have some unease about it, no matter what they say, because if the president can declare an emergency on something that he has created as an emergency, an illusion that he wants to convey, just think of what a president with different values can present to the American people. You want to talk about a national emergency? Let's talk about today, the one-year anniversary of another manifestation of the epidemic of gun violence in America. That's a national emergency. Why don't you declare that emergency, Mr. President? I wish you would. But a Democratic president can do that.
Well, what a Democratic president did was President Obama, with his executive action on immigration. Remember, he halted the deportation of undocumented parents of Dreamers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that I didn't think that was an emergency or rose to a national emergency.
Well, here's the thing. There's two things here. One is the precedent setting. The second is the constitutionality of declaring a national emergency in this space. Is there an emergency? Or is it just like a humanitarian challenge? You know, the sort of parsing of words you get into with Democrats. We play the statistics, the recitation of the violent crime statistics by President Trump, given to him by Homeland Security Secretary Nielsen earlier this week. Tens of thousands of violent crimes, 3,000 murders, tens of thousands of sexual assaults, and, you know, on down the line of Class X felonies. Boy, I tell you, that level of victimization by people in this country illegally, you call that a challenge? Okay. A crime control issue, whatever you want to call it, that certainly falls within the province of the National Emergencies Act. And this is not just me saying it. Legal scholars from Andy McCarthy to Jonathan Turley have also said it. Now, others on the right, like David French, have said it's unconstitutional, disagree. It's okay. You can discuss it. But here's something else about national emergency declarations. So we're doing apples to apples here. There are 31 emergency declarations currently in force. Blocking investment in Burma, prohibiting the import of blood diamonds from Sierra Leone. National emergencies regarding Iranian oil and the movement of vessels near Cuba. So in terms of the precedent-setting argument, I mean, Do you understand where we're at in terms of what a Democrat president might do? A Democrat president might do what Nancy Pelosi is intimating, no matter what President Trump does. Have you seen what the Democrat Socialist Party looks like these days? Do you think they're all of a sudden? I mean, here's when you know that they are out of arguments, when the left is out of arguments. They start referring to the Constitution, which is a workaround for them, except and unless there's a provision that has any immediate utility. Spare me. Oh, if the president doesn't do this, you wouldn't have a President Kamala Harris declare a national emergency and try to ban guns, which is the direction Pelosi was heading. She'd only do it if Trump opened the door. The door's been open. Okay. So let's just get a real handle on where we are, because some of these sort of ivory tower arguments coming from National Review in particular, which I like. And it's okay that Jonah Goldberg and David French don't have the same perspective on Trump that I do or that you do. That's okay. I can tolerate dissent, and you should be able to, too, address the substance of the arguments. But these are the arguments they're making are in a complete vacuum and are Pollyannish with respect to what the left would do if they were to install a president, if they were to have a Democrat socialist in the White House, regardless of what Trump does here. So let's just be honest with ourselves so we can have a substantive conversation. And that includes some of the sort of never Trumpers or sometime Trumpers on the right. Dustin in Elk Grove Village, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, Dan, I was just wondering if you could comment on, say, the advantages maybe in the court for Trump doing a national emergency versus, say, the governor of Texas declaring a state of emergency to get federal funding.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting point. Thanks for the call, Dustin. And it was something we talked a little bit earlier in the week, that is the possibility rather than doing a national emergency, you do a federalist play, right, which is you work with friendly administrations at the state level. Abbott in Texas would be the prime example, to do in concert with state what you can't get done simply through federal action. Because if you were only going to do this compromise funding deal and not do something on the order of the national emergency that Trump is telegraphing he's going to do.
But is anybody upset that they're using our tax dollars and Mexico's not paying for it and the new NAFTA agreement is not paying for the wall?
I mean,
it was great on the campaign trail. We're going to build a wall and Mexico's going to pay for it.
Yeah.
Sounded good.
You could argue that through the strictures of NAFTA, the incremental benefit to the United States, which is arguable, but it's an argument to be made, they're de facto paying for it. They're paying for it through the back door rather than writing a check through the front door. And, I mean, the money thing here, too. Democrats are fiscal conservatives and strict constructionists all of a sudden.
They are.
Right.
They've had a quick change of heart, Dan.
The money, I mean, $4 trillion annual budget. This is a two-party system that has piled up $105 trillion in debt when you include unfunded welfare state liabilities. And now, hey, we want to take a scalpel to funding levels at the border. Come on. As I said, can we just strip away the Pollyannish nonsense and have a honest conversation about what the real dynamics are here? Johnny on the west side.
Good morning.
Morning.
I don't know why the Democrats fight this wall, because when they turn it into Venezuela, they can keep the people from leaving.
Yeah, there you go. Right. Thanks for the call, Johnny. Yeah, it's a wall East Germany style. Exactly. Bruno in Naperville.
Yeah, two things. One, about her, you know, there's nothing like the Second Amendment, though, protecting people trying to come over this border illegally. So the analogy that she made really isn't a good one. And the other thing, of course, is that if they were to try that, there's probably 10 or 25 million Americans who would shoot back to prevent it from happening. So
thanks for the call, Bruno. Tom in Deer Park.
Dan, good morning. You laid out a couple of the brighter minds than mine that I mentioned to your screener, including David French, Jonah Goldberg, certainly brighter minds than mine, as I'm no expert, but did a lot of reading. Ilya Shapiro, Ilya Soman, all think that it's not only unconstitutional but possibly illegal. But put that aside for a second. For Mitch McConnell to go on the floor and back this, nobody knows better than Mitch McConnell that this is not going to fly and that it's going to go to the courts. So shame on him, first of all, for acquiescing to Trump and Trumpism and not doing what a branch of government is supposed to do and check the executive. And second of all, for the rest of us that are just out here on our radios and televisions that really work in 10, 12-hour days and taking care of their kids, we're looking for bright commentary and don't have time to read National Review and Reason and Cato and all that. And there's definitely two sides to it, and you do cover both. But I want to say one thing, and I appreciate you taking my call. The majority of talk radio doesn't do what you guys do on your station, and they're in the tank for the president just as much. I find it very disappointing, and thank you for doing your show.
Thanks, Tom. So here's the thing. 1976 National Emergencies Act gives presidents sweeping authority. This is from Jonathan Turley, law professor, George Washington. Sweeping authority, including an express allowance to declare an immigration emergency to deal with, quote, an influx of aliens, which either is of such magnitude or exhibits such other characteristics that effective administration of the immigration laws of the United States is beyond the existing capabilities of immigration authorities in the affected area or areas. Well, based on those crime stats alone, based on the number of people in this country illegally,
Based on the wait time to see an immigration judge. I mean, you have to wait 2 to 3 months. That would clarify as an emergency.
Yeah, based on the, I'm here with my friends and I demand entry caravans. Boy, I think that fits in. Here's the other thing about it. Congress has oversight over the emergency declaration. They can vote to overturn the emergency declaration, and the president can veto it, and then they can override his veto with 2/3 majority. So there is a sort of due process. There is a due process protocol here with respect to these declarations, animated by federal statute, involves the right of Congress to engage and the right of the president to engage after Congress has, just as any other piece of legislation. So I don't find the unconstitutional, much less illegal, arguments particularly compelling. Randy and Sandwich.
All right, to answer Amy's question real quick, Mexico is going to be paying for the wall. It's going to be through El Chapo's money. Ted Cruz is working on it.
Oh, come on. So silly.
$14 billion, yeah.
But okay. I think what we need to do here is we need to look what President Trump is saying, and then we can build this timeline and see where this is going to end up. When he went ahead and opened the government and everybody freaked out that he caved and he totally just gave in. I think that's all a plan up until this point and going to lead us to the 2020 election. And here's what it is. So he opens it back up. Everybody freaks out. He said in a couple meetings that it was pointless to even talk to Nancy and Chuck because they don't want to talk. All they want to do is sit there and come up with reasons why they can't do anything to get along in order to be able to get something passed. So then all of a sudden during his last rally, he starts indicating that he possibly could be doing a thing where he's going to declare a national emergency, and he's setting the stage. And that's the key thing right there. What he's saying is, and this is what I think he's doing an excellent job of, before Trump, Democrats would like to whisper off the side the things that they like to do and they get accomplished, abortion after birth. But they don't want to say it out in the public. Well, what Trump is good at doing is he's making them come to the microphone and say exactly what they think. And now that he's going to declare this national emergency, how easy is it going to be for Nancy to stand there and say, I'm okay with sex traffickers coming to this country. I'm okay with drug traffickers coming to this country. Now it's going to embarrass them all the way till 2020. And if he can run on this, he can embarrass them and then have people from like the independents come his way and old-time modern Democrats come his way. And then eventually he will be able to get reelected because of it. That's my theory.
All right. Thanks for the call, Randy. Here's the thing. It's interesting. Just picking up on what Randy had to say. One thing you're saying was this is going to split the Republican Party because there are many Republicans that don't want him to invoke national emergency powers, Marco Rubio, among others.
Susan Collins.
Oh, right. The usual suspects. There's a couple of ways to look at that. One is to say, oh, there'll be dissension in the ranks of the Republicans. Another way to look at it is, boy, he's positioning himself for 2020 to own the same market space he did in 2016, which is, I don't care about the parties. Oh, some Republicans are mad at me, some Democrats are mad at me. I don't care about the parties. I'm the guy who does or efforts to do what I said I was going to do, and I'll put in the fight to do it against both parties. And that's a pretty good position to be in. So this may get hung up in the courts for a while, but it sets the stage for the discussion framed out nicely by our friend Randy, and also the market position that Trump needs to own to get reelected.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Boy, it's really something to watch, isn't it? It is really something to watch the breathless promotion of Andy McCabe's new book and his forthcoming interview on 60 Minutes this weekend with Scott Pelley.
Oh, the slow rollout of dribs and drabs of information.
No, that's not the problem. The problem is they're taking what he has to say as gospel and not adding the contextual information for the viewer, not presenting the institutional knowledge they have that Andy McCabe was fired as the deputy director for lying.
Yeah.
He was fired for lying.
Fired for lying and giving reporters information, leaking information, which is something he should not be doing. So and he got canned for it.
So, I mean, so Scott Pelley and all of the others that are running around talking in hushed tones about these important revelations of McCabe's as reflective on the president, rather on McCabe and his colleagues and their conduct. The counterintelligence investigation of the president, the allegations of concern about anything impeding a Russian collusion investigation that 2 years in has turned up donut. It's obscene. Or is somebody want to argue, and maybe this should be asked, is the Inspector General, DOJ Inspector General Horowitz, testified before Congress. I haven't heard anyone impugn his integrity. No one. It's his report that was the basis for McCabe's termination. So just remember that, because you're not going to hear from Scott Pelley or any of the other mouth breathers on CBS. And I'm sure the D.C. press corps will follow suit because of the sensational quality of the allegations. Just remember that about Andy McCabe when you hear this.
I was speaking to the man who had just run for the presidency and won the election for the presidency, and who might have done so with the aid of the government of Russia, our most formidable adversary on the world stage. And that was something that troubled me greatly.
How long was it after that that you decided to start the obstruction of justice and counterintelligence investigations involving the president?
I think the next day I met with the team investigating the Russia cases, and I asked the team to go back and conduct an assessment to determine where are we with these efforts and what steps do we need to take going forward. I was very concerned that I was able to put the Russia case on absolutely solid ground in an indelible fashion, that were I removed quickly or reassigned or fired, that the case could not be closed or vanish in the night without a trace. I wanted to make sure that our case was on solid ground, and if somebody came in behind me and closed it and tried to walk away from it, they would not be able to do that without creating a record of why they'd made that decision.
And it's funny because I have yet to hear anybody, including those who despise President Trump, those fired by President Trump or fired by superiors at Justice, as McCabe was. I have no one to allege that anything was done at any time to impede their investigation. Now, McCabe talks about the president trying to convince him that people were very supportive of his firing of Comey, and McCabe saying, no, 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 there are people in the FBI that are crying over his termination. Well, so what? So some people liked him and some people didn't. In a big organization, hardly a surprise or a controversy.
But yeah, he couldn't tell the president that because he was alarmed.
Yeah.
He didn't want to upset him.
And here's the other big reveal from McCabe. He confirms, again, his credibility notwithstanding, confirms this 25th Amendment action against the president was discussed. The idea of wiring up soon-to-be former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein was a real thing, not a joke.
Yeah, it wasn't a joke.
And that they were sort of trying to handicap the cabinet in terms of how many votes they might have to remove the president. For what? We'll see.
They said he's not mentally sound, mentally fit to hold office.
We'll see if Scott Pelley provides it when the full interview airs on Sunday. But based on what evidence? What evidence would put you in a position other than, what evidence?
So they fired Comey, so they wanted to get back him. So there is no evidence. They're going to drum up evidence.
Well, right. So is this is political ideology being advanced, not evidence-driven concern for the country, the point.
Vice President Mike Pence spoke with MSNBC and talked about the 25th, but you want to play your audio.
Well, McCabe's allegation. Okay.
There was a discussion underway about removing
Scott
the president of the United States.
They were counting noses. They were not asking cabinet members whether they would vote for or against removing the president, but they were speculating this person would be with us, that person would not be, and they were counting noses in that effort.
And this was not perceived to be a joke.
This was not perceived to be a joke. Mm-hmm. It was also said at a previous time that the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, offered to wear a wire into the White House to record potentially incriminating conversations with the president. A statement was released after that was never serious, it was sarcastic, etc. McCabe, in our interview, says no. It came up more than once, and it was so serious that he took it to the lawyers at the FBI to discuss it.
Mm. And yesterday, Rosenstein responded, saying McCabe's statement is, quote, factually incorrect, unquote, and reminding the press corps, what I did, that McCabe was fired for lying.
Well, one person that would have to be a part of the conversation if they were going to try and get President Trump on the 25th Amendment would be Vice President Mike Pence.
I never heard of it. I never heard of any discussion of the 25th Amendment. And frankly, I find any suggestion of it to be absurd. This president's been producing for the American people, and I couldn't be more proud to stand with him. And the words or the writings of a disgrace.
Yeah, but the allegation is not that they talked to Pence or any other cabinet official. The allegation is they did some internal handicapping. Yeah. Here's the thing.
They were seeing who was with them, the yeas and the nays.
What does this say about, again, the senior leadership of the FBI and DOJ right up to present day? So you had an acting director, a deputy director, and an acting director before Ray's installed in McCabe, fired. Him and Rosenstein, who's been the acting AG for the purposes of the Russian collusion investigation, and after the Sessions resignation, however you want to describe it, before Bill Barr is installed, which he's been confirmed now, so that should happen shortly. But I mean, these guys, they are offering two entirely different accounts of this aspect of their working relationship and what they were doing vis-a-vis the president of the United States. And the problem we're supposed to focus on, or the person we're supposed to focus on, is President Trump. I say again, how about the fifth column action going on at Justice and in the FBI? I mean, Andy McCabe's new book, you seen this? His new book is entitled The Threat.
The Threats.
A subtitle: How the FBI Protects America in the Age of Terror and Trump. as if terror and Trump are synonyms. This is so disgraceful. I mean, President Trump is right to call McCabe a disgrace to our country. It's unsubstantiated. His statements run into conflict with Comey. His statements run into conflict with Rosenstein. Who are you to believe among these guys, if any of them? But the president is the problem. I'll tell you, Kim Strassel had a good write-up on Bill Barr in the Wall Street Journal, the hot mess that he's inheriting. Strassel suggests it's Barr's opening. For the first time in this presidency, the Justice Department will have a leader who is apart from the Russia stink, neither accused of collusion nor obsessed with finding it. And she suggests it's an opportunity to reset the deck and also attempt to reestablish the credibility of these important agencies, writing, whether the Justice Department and FBI's most controversial actions were appropriate, something that should be determined and addressed. Is it acceptable for the FBI to use opposition research as an excuse to surveil a political campaign, to use back channels to stay in touch with sources it fired, to open counterintel investigations into political figures, to actively hide those investigations from congressional overseers, to hold meetings about removing presidents? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, Americans deserve to know that this is the brave new world they live in. Absolutely. Absolutely, those questions should be asked, and the answer should be sought by Bill Barr and publicized.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Dan and Amy, it's time for another lesson in AOCnomics.
Hey, can you believe what she did?
Hashtag MABA, make Alexandria bartender again. She's not going to be an Amazon employee because Amazon has decided to scrap their New York City headquarters. And AOC...
Well, she had a party yesterday.
Couldn't have been happier about it.
We were subsidizing those jobs. So for the city was paying for those jobs. So frankly, if we were willing to give Amazon to give away $3 billion for this deal, we could invest those $3 billion in our district ourselves if we wanted to. We could hire out more teachers. We can fix our subways. We can put a lot of people to work for that money if we wanted to.
Not 25,000 people there, honey.
Well, here's the other thing, just sort of the first principle. Okay, so, and I'm not for the subsidies and that sort of crony capitalism with respect to Amazon, so it's not a defense of that. But this idea of no subsidies for private sector jobs, but a guarantee of a federal government job for every American who wants one, and in addition, subsidies for people who don't. So I'm a little unclear about Ocasio-Cortez's position on government incentives or taxpayer funding, taxpayer underwriting of jobs, or taxpayer underwriting of people who don't want jobs.
I don't think she understands it easier. One person who was surprised, of course, was Governor Cuomo and Mayor Bill de Blasio.
Instead of an actual dialogue to try and resolve those issues, we get a call this morning saying we're taking our ball and we're going home. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, they were blindsided. They weren't part of the conversation. They were left out. But you know what?
Andrew Cuomo's
Jeff
lying.
Bezos?
Andrew Cuomo's lying.
Why?
Daily News reporting Thursday, Cuomo and a group of labor unions met with Amazon earlier in the week to try and salvage the deal.
Oh.
But when the company refused to relent on its opposition to unions being formed among its employees and the employees tasked with building the new facilities it planned to inhabit, it put Cuomo and other politicians in a, quote, tricky spot. The real story here is not Ocasio-Cortez. The real story here is Cuomo and the unions trying to hold up Amazon, and they said, go pound sand.
They did. And instead, now, don't anyone get excited. They're not coming to Chicago.
Well, of course
not. Well, Mayor Emanuel last week said that he was hoping, and he was trying to get in with them again to bring their headquarters here. What they're going to do is they're going to expand their locations in Nashville and in Northern Virginia.
Mm.
So we're not going to go through this whole rigmarole again to see if we can have Amazon here.
On another matter of federal funds, taxpayer dollars being used to support those investments that Ocasio-Cortez likes to talk about, you know, like the $77 billion high-speed bullet train that has been scrapped in California. It's supposed to go from L.A. to
San Francisco.
San Francisco, yeah.
And then Sacramento to San Diego or something, too.
Trump wants the money back
that
federal government provided.
He tweeted that out to the governor of California. We want cash back.
They owe the federal government $3.5 billion. We want the money back. Whole project is a quote-unquote green disaster. I love it. Well done, Mr. President. Ken in Lombard, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I am in agreement that we do not want to make carve-outs for specific entities in the private sector that in the long run kick back money to these politicians that provided them with these favors.
Yeah.
But in the big picture of things, where this Ms. AOC word don't get, is that you want to create an environment that all people are level at the table, and then everybody comes out with the people have figured out what they want, not what's getting rammed down their throat. She just doesn't get it.
She doesn't get it. She doesn't want to get it. She's in the business of ramming things down people's throats, and that's all the Democrat socialists. Exactly right, Ken.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
That's enough. Put down the mic.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Will Jussie Smollett's Empire spinoff be picked up before he is? Chicago police still treating him as a victim in the alleged attack, but it seems like that is not going to be sustainable for much longer.
Well, we found out right now that he and two Nigerian brothers, one who was an extra on Empire, are still being questioned at 51st and Wentworth because they're investigating an allegation that this was staged because Jussie Smollett's character was about to be written off of Empire.
Well, the attorney for the two brothers suggests that they could be as charged as soon as today. And the interesting thing would be, well, what will they be charged for? Will they be charged for attacking Jussie Smollett? Or are they going to be charged with, lying, I guess, being party to a conspiracy to file a false police report?
Well, the two Nigerians left on the day of the purported attack. They flew back to Nigeria. They came back to O'Hare on Wednesday, and that's when they were picked up by Chicago police. They also raided their apartment, and in their apartment they found bleach, which, normal people have bleach in their house if they do laundry, a wallet with stamps, a magazine that may be linked to a threatening letter that was sent to Jussie Smollett on the set of Empire. There are computers, and they're looking for other things like possible string that was used.
Well, right. So,
in the attack.
So I guess it's possible that these two brothers were trying to hold up Jussie Smollett for some reason, and they, used the race stuff and the anti-gay stuff and the Trump stuff as their cover story, and Smollett's not party to it. And that's how they were able to recognize Jussie from across the street at 2 a.m. in the morning.
And yell, "Hey, Empire guy."
Right, because they, at least one of them knew him or certainly had enough interactions with him to know who he was. So that's one possibility, I guess, if you still want to hold out hope that Jussie Smollett is an innocent party here. But the story that's being reported by ABC and CBS and others with their respective multiple unnamed sources is that this was a staged attack that included Smollett, and the purpose was to prevent him from being written off the show.
Here's their attorney.
The people of interest, my clients, they do know Jussie. They have worked with him on Empire. My preliminary investigations show that on set, it's very tight. They're all very cordial with each other. So they're baffled why they are people of interest.
And the brothers are, some publications have identified them. They're brothers, yes, they both went to Lakeview. They live in Wrigleyville, Lakeview High School.
Right.
They have to charge them or release them by 5:45 p.m. tonight because that's the 48-hour, mandated custody time.
Right.
So
both have some
records.
Criminal activity
that.
In their background. The brother who appeared on Empire is an extra. Was charged with attempted murder in Cook County in 2011. He pled down to aggravated battery. His brother charged with DUI near their home in 2015 when he was 21 years old. No other arrests in the city since 2014, according to Chicago police records. The outcome of the DUI case not immediately available. So, I mean, that doesn't necessarily go to them being inveterate criminals or something. I just don't know how. I mean, should hasten to add, the Empire folks said, oh, no, we weren't writing Jussie Smollett off the show.
Yeah, that's what they said in a tweet yesterday, but I'm not buying that. I mean, the show basically is going to be going away soon. Everybody who works on that show that has spoken said, yeah, it's nearing its end anyway. But the fact that this alleged victim is being so, you know, just lauded over by Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, everyone, even ABC couldn't stop themselves from, you know, this poor guy.
Jussie Smollett, he's answering questions about his story for the first time.
He really is, George. And the incident has sparked both an outpouring of support as well as questions about what happened that night on a cold Chicago street. Jussie was very passionate in his account, detailing the racist and homophobic words he says his attackers use, words that we cannot broadcast.
Yeah, there's also this. Smollett is reportedly employed the same PR firm, Sunshine Sachs, to help him manage the comms here that Harvey Weinstein used after he was charged with all of the things that he was charged with doing.
But I watched that interview again.
This just prompts another question. Well, why does the alleged victim of an alleged hate crime need a PR firm?
Because of this, because he's being accused of staging.
Well, now
an attack
he does.
On
yeah, right.
Because of this, but you know, he's on a lot of this. If this does turn out to be true that this attack was staged, he should never have gone on ABC News and made the comments. I mean, he said, "I want young gay men who are watching this at home to learn to fight back."
Yeah,
I mean, it was so pathetic, and you could tell if you're watching the interview, his eyes were shifting. He was not. I just did not believe that he was telling the truth. And then he talked about President Trump, because this is political. And why is this political? Because he alleges that the two people that did this to him said, this is MAGA country. And he will not refer to President Trump as President Trump, just a number.
I come really, really hard against 45. I come really, really hard against his administration. And I don't hold my tongue.
Yeah. Okay, what does that have to, I mean, I'm not sure what that has to do with anything, but it does, right.
It speaks to the fact that he does not like President Trump so much, Dan, that he can't use his name. He's just a number.
Well, I understand, and that would also speak to sort of introducing that as part of the plot line in this pilot that Jussie Smollett seems to have put together.
I mean, where do you think they went to rehearse this? Do you think they, you know, just rehearsed it a half hour before, or maybe on the set of Empire, they who came up with this scheme? Like, what are we going to do? All right, you be the one that puts the clothing line around my neck, and then I'll pretend it's a noose. And then I'll go on Good Morning America and say that I just looked up and the noose was around my neck, but then later claim that I had a rope burn on my neck. See, his story wasn't consistent when I was watching it.
No, it was not consistent. And by the way, you have friends on the Chicago Police Force, so why? I mean, just internally, the chatter. There's nobody that you can find who has believed his story from the get-go.
No. And it doesn't matter what color or gender you are. No, anyone who's a cop knows that this is a bunch of bull jive. And one thing that I love is that there is an Ace Hardware in Wrigleyville, right near where these guys live, near Sheridan and Byram. And I called over there because I know that I used to live in that area. And I'm telling you, they didn't confirm or deny that the clothing line was purchased there. Which would make sense because it's right around the corner from where they live.
So if this Jussie spinoff doesn't get picked up, what should he do with his life?
312-642-5600 is Turnkey Depro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. And could he be charged than filing a false police report? Can he be charged with a hate crime because he's stirred up so much hate?
Charged with a hate crime
people?
On himself?
Yeah.
I mean, charge him with bad writing? I don't know. I understand, of course, if you're going to make up a story, you might as well turn out to be the hero
in
it.
Did he pay these two Nigerian brothers to do this? I mean, we don't know. There's
I mean,
so many questions that have to be answered. And he's got to start singing like a bird because those guys have been there again. They have to release them by 5:45 p.m. tonight, release them or charge them. And Jussie did not show up for his first interview yesterday morning, but they did reach him, and he's at, I was told, 51st and Wentworth, still talking to police.
Well, this is going to come to a head one way or the other,
yes,
and we'll see what Chicago police do, where the facts lead them to go. One thought, since he's so virulently anti-Trump.
Yeah. No, sorry, excuse me, it's 45.
He and Brian Williams could co-host a show on MSNBC.
Oh.
They're both great storytellers, particularly stories that are fictional where they're the hero. I think it'd be a good team. Dave in Downers Grove.
Yeah, good morning, Dan and Amy. Hey, I want to know, how do two Nigerian brothers get money to go back and forth to Nigeria? Maybe they should look for where the money came from. And also, if two guys from Chicago beat this guy up in a polar vortex, he wouldn't have walked away. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Dave. By the way, also, the two Nigerian brothers?
Yes, just went to Lakeview, and then they played football at Quincy University.
Yeah, yeah. If they were in a fight with Jussie?
You look at these guys. They would kick him from here to Toledo.
They are beasts, these guys. These are big, cut
big dudes. Yeah.
If they got in a real fight, like they were actually targeting Jussie and he's innocent, there wouldn't be anything left of Jussie such that you would need dental records to identify him, let me just tell you. So that whole thing just doesn't wash. One of them would have made him a stain on the road. The two of them together?
I mean, he wouldn't be alive.
He fought back, and then they ran away?
He fought back, this guy?
Take a look, big dude? Those guys look like a tiny Lister. Except they're bigger.
Here. Well, yeah, again, they've both got full rides to Quincy University to play football. They're football players. They're in shape. They're ripped.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk about a four-pack. They got an eight-pack.
Boy, oh, boy.
Oh, this is getting better.
I sure hope this doesn't turn out where there's a lot of egg on the face of Hollywood elites and Democrat Pauls. And, well, golly, that would just be terrible.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
So, remember when Jussie Smollett said this about his attackers?
As I was crossing the intersection, I heard Empire. And I don't answer to Empire. My name ain't Empire. And I didn't answer. I kept walking, and then I heard Empire. So I turned around and I said, did you just say to me? And I see the attacker masked. And he said, this MAGA country punches me right in the face. So I punched his back. And then we started tussling. You know, it was very icy. And we ended up tussling by the stairs. Fighting. There was a second person involved who was kicking me in my back. And then it just stopped. And they ran off. And I saw where they ran.
Uh-huh. I posted the picture on Twitter of the two guys who are persons of interest, who Jussie says are the ones who attacked him, the silhouettes that were caught on that video camera.
Yeah.
You hear what you just said. One of them punched me. And then I punched back, and then the other was kicking me, and then they ran away. You look at those two guys and Jussie, and you tell me if you believe that story. Okay? I'm just going to leave it there. Yeah. If one of those guys punched Jussie, he would no longer be featuring anything above his neck. Okay?
Yeah, and he'd have a concussion, and he'd be in a coma, probably.
Oh, good grief. Richard on the north side.
I just wonder when European-Americans, Caucasian-Americans, are going to start doing actions and protest marches and that kind of stuff. Because the three of us right now, we are not black people or Hispanic or anything. And none of us have any ill will, any kind of prejudice, any kind of dislike for people who are not white. In fact, when you see a good person who is a good person, a fine person who is a fine person, none of us, the three of us who are talking right now, none of us have any animosity. And we need to start saying, hey, quit calling me a nasty, you know what? Because I'm white. This is bull. We need to stand up and fight. And that means not physically and all that crap, but with actions and start doing what they do on the left. And okay. and they'll go away within a short time.
All right, thanks,
anyway,
Richard.
Anyway, that's what I got
to
say.
Thanks, appreciate the call.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. President Trump will be addressing the nation from the Rose Garden at 9 a.m. Chicago time.
And you can hear it here. We'll have it for you.
He'll be explaining ostensibly why he's going to sign the bipartisan compromise on border security funding that has been leveled up to his desk, and also reportedly declare a national emergency for the purposes of commandeering other funds for border security, so said Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor yesterday.
I've just had an opportunity to speak with President Trump, and he, I would say to all my colleagues, has indicated he's prepared to sign the bill. He will also be issuing a national emergency declaration at the same time. And I've indicated to him that I'm going to support the national emergency declaration. So for all of my colleagues, the president will sign the bill.
Okay, so that's happening. Pelosi responding. She's not indicating yet whether they will seek legal action. She is indicating, though, that this precedent is dangerous.
There's nothing, Chicago.
Did I ever say I was filing a legal challenge?
You said Democrats.
I may. That's an option, and we'll review our options. But it's important to note that when the president declares this emergency, first of all, it's not an emergency, what's happening at the border. It's a humanitarian challenge to a president that has tried to sell a bill of goods to American people. But putting that aside, just in terms of the president making an end run around Congress, here he said, let us respect what the committee will do, and then walks away from it.
Well, he respected what the committee would do. He's going to sign it, but he's going to offer a little kicker too.
And she went on to say, you know, the real emergency, because it's the anniversary of the Parkland shooting, that gun violence should be a national emergency.
Yeah, and it's something that some conservatives and other stock and trade Republicans have suggested. Well, this is a dangerous precedent setting. Not really. 31 national emergencies declared in the last 3 decades.
Yeah.
A range of topics.
Yeah, well, President Obama declared a national emergency to stop the deportation of Dreamers' parents. Remember that? That was the last one we had. Was that really a national emergency?
Well, number two, the crime stats that President Trump read off, provided to him by Secretary Nielsen earlier in the week. Boy, they certainly suggest something. You don't want to call it a national emergency. Okay, 3,000 murders and 10,000 sexual assaults and on up with respect to the tens of thousands of violent crimes, class X felonies committed by people here illegally. That's something. That's a challenge. It's an issue. It's a law enforcement problem. Is it a national emergency? Oh, I don't know. And so the president is going to take what he could get from Congress, and he's going to take what he can get through the use of his executive power. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined again by Mark Morgan. He's a former FBI agent. He was also the Customs and Border Protection chief under President Obama. Mark, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks for having me on.
What did you think of, what do you think of both parts of this, I suppose? Take them in whichever order you want. The deal that the president is going to sign, and the decision he's made to exercise his national emergency powers.
Yeah, so first, real quick, let me address the current Speaker of the House comments that it's not emergency. You both just hit it. I mean, look at the crime stats, I'm not going to repeat them. You just went down, and there's a heck of a lot more. We could do 20 minutes just on all the stats that are fact and hyperbole. Look at the current flow of those individuals seeking asylum. Right now, we're averaging 60,000 a month. Monday of just this week, 2,000 in one day. So far this year, 62 caravans of 100 or more. They had 13 of all last year. And she's going to say that this is not a crisis. It's absolutely unbelievable, misleading the people. Now, let's take this bill. And I don't say this easily. This bill is horrible. There's some good things in the bill, but there's some significant landmines in this bill. So, right, they talk about, so now Congress in this bill tells the Border Patrol, the experts, where they need the wall, what type of wall, and how they can build it. In the areas in the Texas area, the areas where they need it, one of the areas they need it the most, they're forcing them that they have to deal with local government before they can build it. And oh, by the way, we know that the local government, because they've already expressed their opinions, they're against the barrier. So that will result in the rest of this fiscal year of no barrier being built. Then in section 232A, they talk about that there's five areas that they can't build a barrier, including the National Butterfly Center. Not making it up. It's in the bill.
And is it?
They cannot build.
And right? Also, besides the National Butterfly Center, I've heard of that. There's people's where the wall would go through their backyard. Are you familiar with that?
Yes. And so the issue is, and that's not new. So the 654 miles of barrier that have been built, there's always those challenges. But my response is they just leveled a landmark restaurant here where I live, the Globe and Laura, through eminent domain to build an extra wide road. I mean, but yet people are not supporting it when we have 4,000 murders, 100,000 assaults, 30,000 sexual. I mean, it's 6,000 gang members deported in the last 2 years. And they're worried about taking a little bit of land, right, for our national security. I mean, by saying there's five significant areas where you can't build a wall at all, I mean, that's creating a sanctuary border. I mean, you might as well put a sign to the cartels that says, come here, come through here. And they will, and they've already do. If you look at some of those national parks that are there, they're already going through, and they're trashing those parks. Just talk to the people who support those areas. The last thing I'll say is Section 224. This is the biggest issue of all, is that they are actually creating a new kind of amnesty. They are saying that ICE, if an individual that's here sponsors an unaccompanied minor, this bill says that ICE cannot do their job. ICE cannot touch them. Even if that sponsor is here illegally, and the stats will show that most sponsors of unaccompanied minors are here illegally, this bill says that ICE cannot touch them. And it's not just a sponsor, but it's a potential sponsor. It's anybody that lives in the household of a sponsor. And this is truly unbelievable. It creates amnesty.
So then what is what would you advise the president? Would you advise him to not sign this, to veto this, and just to declare a national emergency? Or in the interest of politics, and you can't eliminate politics from the consideration, it's always part of it, go ahead and sign it and make up for the deficiencies, and some of which you've described, through your national emergency powers and the other resources you can access?
Yeah, so I think that's the question. That's a great question. So, you know, from my perspective is that these landmines that are in this current bill are so significant, he shouldn't sign this bill. He should do a CR and go back to Congress and say sections 231, 232A, and 224, you got to fix. You got to eliminate those sections. You eliminate those sections, re-sign it. He signs the bill then, and then he declares a national emergency.
By the way, just getting your reaction to just in terms of what he's up against. Not you heard from Pelosi, but Beto O'Rourke yesterday. Ask the obvious questions. If walls are immoral, should we take down the border barriers? Should we take down the wall in El Paso? And you know what he said? Yes.
Oh, he did. He did.
Yes.
Has he ever been to El Paso? I lived
he
in,
lives
El
in El Paso.
Well, I know. Well, still.
So, but I mean, Mark, react to that. That's what the president's dealing with.
So that's exactly right. And you phrased it perfectly. That's what he's dealing with. Right? So they are absolutely... So experts that have dedicated, and this isn't hyperbole either, experts that have dedicated their lives to defending the borders and protecting this country. Border Patrol agents, 128, have died doing that, and they have learned through the decades of their blood, sweat, and tears of what it means to secure the borders. They've told Congress what they need, and Congress has said, nope, we reject you. And not only do they reject you, then you have congressmen like that just says, just crazy, irresponsible, reckless, false statements. And it's beyond frustrating. And it's ironic because how about 2006 when both sides of the Al Paso Secure Fence Act, that led to the 654 miles being built. 2013, Congress and the Senate passed a bipartisan bill that had $8 billion for a wall. And oh, by the way, even though this bill is horrible, it still has 1.3 miles of barrier. What is it? What is it for the Democratic Party? Either it's immoral, ineffective, or it's not.
Yeah, they're always trying to get votes. As a former U.S. Border Patrol chief, what is the worst thing that you've seen on the job?
You know, so, guys, great question. So really, it's two sides, and this is why the president is accurate when he says this is both a humanitarian and national security incident, right? And so, because you've got two different things going on, they're equally both crises. So on the humanitarian side, one of the things that I will never forget, I will take to my grave, is I'm in RGV, by the way, the area that they're limiting and say you've got to talk to locals in areas where you can't build. I'm in that area, and I see a six-year-old girl that's standing there as the Border Patrol agents knelt down talking to her, trying to calm her. This six-year-old girl, her parents had given her to the coyotes to make the 1,000-mile journey, being subjected to who know what, so she could come to the United States. And they did that. They took that risk because of our broken laws, because they knew that she set one foot on American soil, she would be allowed into the United States, never to be heard from again. That moment, I teared up seeing that six-year-old girl and thinking about, we could fix this. Congress could fix this, but they refused to. On the national security side, I actually participated as an observer in an operation where coyotes, the cartels, had sent coyotes miles into the United States in some really tough terrain, and they had created an observation post. And why do you think they did that? So they could watch Border Patrol, and they're sophisticated and they have communications, so they could watch Border Patrol, and as then they're engaged in one area, they would radio to the coyotes so that drugs and bad people could come in around the Border Patrol agents. Happens every day, all day, because 60% of our border is porous and open.
He is Mark Morgan, former FBI special agent and former Customs and Border Protection chief under President Obama. Mark, thanks as always for joining us, providing your expertise. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
So Jason Van Dyke's wife, Tiffany, came forward yesterday in a tearful response to her husband allegedly being beaten up in prison. Actually, it wasn't alleged, because they received a phone call from the federal prison in Danbury, Connecticut, from a person who works at the jail saying that her husband suffered minor injuries. He had face injuries and head injuries when a bunch of inmates, they didn't say the exact amount, went into his cell and beat him up.
I don't need people to go into his cell and attack him. The next time this could happen, they could kill him. I cannot bury my husband.
And we do know that this attack was because of this case. It was not random.
Yeah, clearly, it was not random. And since the incident, he's been in lockdown 23 hours a day. He's not allowed to have any visitors, nor write emails or make phone calls in this isolated area of the prison.
Maybe Jussie Smollett could be introduced as his cellmate and protect him, since he was able to fight off those two Nigerian brothers who attacked him.
Too soon. Too soon. I mean, we're glad Jason Van Dyke's okay. I'm personally glad that he did not suffer any severe injuries. But he was moved to this prison. They didn't even tell the family that he was being moved. And then they were trying to look for him for 2 days, and that's when they got a phone call from an employee at the federal prison saying they're concerned about his safety.
Immediately upon arrival, Jason was placed in general population as if he was led like a lamb to the slaughter.
There is a responsibility on law enforcement. There is a responsibility on our leaders to make sure that he is protected.
Well, yeah, there's a responsibility on the prisons to keep the prisoners safe. There's no question. You feel bad for the family. You feel bad for his wife.
Well, some officers are asking for the governor to commute his sentence
because there's no
safe place for him anywhere.
Everybody
in the world saw that video.
Ridiculous. You don't commute his sentence because you can't keep a prisoner safe. That's absurd. I get it. You disagree with the verdict, or people disagree with the verdict, and they want to see him released.
They disagree with the sentencing, and so does our Attorney General Kwame Raoul and that special prosecutor Joseph McMahon, who won the convictions against Van Dyke. Remember, on sentencing day, he was fine with the sentence, but now all of a sudden it's political because Kwame Raoul is the new big bad attorney in town or in the state, and they're teaming up together to try and get his sentence.
To resentence him. Add more years.
Yeah.
Look, the judge handed down the sentence. If it's within the guidelines, within the guidelines. Yes, it's political posturing by Kwame Raoul. But this idea that because he was attacked, he doesn't have to serve out the sentence that was meted out, the conviction that was handed down by the jury? No. I mean, I'm sorry, but no. Doesn't work that way.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Bill Barr's hot mess, writes Kim Strassel, Wall Street Journal. And I think she sticks the landing yet again. For the first time in this presidency, the Justice Department will have a leader who is apart from the Russia stink, neither accused of collusion nor obsessed with finding it. He's also uniquely suited to understand the importance of credibility and accountability, having worked in the 70s at CIA, then under intense fire, and of course, Attorney General previously. And Strassel offers a lot of questions that need compelling answers. Is it acceptable for the FBI to use opposition research as an excuse to surveil a political campaign, to use back channels to stay in touch with sources at fire, to open counterintel investigations into political figures, to actively hide those investigations from congressional overseers, to hold meetings about removing presidents? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, Americans deserve to know that this is the brave new world they live in. Absolutely. And you're getting another taste of it, because you have another disgraced former senior official at FBI who's got a book out. And that means the breathless Scott Pelley interview on CNN, which was previewed yesterday. Andy McCabe, Scott Pelley did not mention this. Nobody on the CBS panel discussing the interview did either. Fired for lying.
Yeah, that never came out.
The Inspector General report, has anybody impugned the integrity or fairness of Michael Horowitz, the DOJ Inspector General? And the report he compiled that led to Mr. McCabe's termination. Just asking, because I don't get that sort of context.
And the book is titled, by the way, The Threat, How the FBI Protects America in the Age of Terror and Trump.
Terror and Trump. Synonyms.
Yes.
Or compliments at minimum, right? Yeah. That's how we're supposed to take that. Here's McCabe talking Russian collusion.
I was speaking to the man who had just run for the presidency and won the election for the presidency, and who might have done so with the aid of the government of Russia, our most formidable adversary on the world stage. And that was something that troubled me greatly.
How long was it after that that you decided to start the obstruction of justice and counterintelligence investigations involving the president?
I think the next day I met with the team investigating the Russia cases. And I asked the team to go back and conduct an assessment to determine where are we with these efforts and what steps do we need to take going forward. I was very concerned that I was able to put the Russia case on absolutely solid ground in an indelible fashion, that were I removed quickly or reassigned or fired, that the case could not be closed or vanish in the night without a trace. I wanted to make sure that our case was on solid ground, and if somebody came in behind me and closed it and tried to walk away from it, they would not be able to do that without creating a record of why they'd made that decision.
Right. Okay. Again, this is Andy McCabe, hero. Andy McCabe, Jack Ryan. Then Scott Pelley goes on to characterize something else McCabe told him that made headlines yesterday, confirming confirming in quotation marks because, again, he's fired for lying.
Right.
Confirming that, yes, there was a movement afoot within Justice to move on President Trump.
There was a discussion underway about removing the president of the United States.
They were counting noses. They were not asking cabinet members whether they would vote for or against removing the president, but they were speculating this person would be with us, that person would not be, and they were counting noses in that effort.
And this was not perceived to be a joke.
This was not perceived to be a joke. Mm-hmm. It was also said at a previous time that the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, offered to wear a wire mm-hmm. into the White House to record potentially incriminating conversations with the president. A statement was released after that that was never serious, it was sarcastic, etc. McCabe, in our interview, says no. It came up more than once, and it was so serious that he took it to the lawyers at the FBI to discuss it.
And soon-to-be former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein said no. What McCabe is saying is, quote, factually incorrect, unquote. And Rosenstein mentioned in his statement what Scott Pelley didn't about McCabe, that he was fired for lying to the DOJ IG. You know, who to believe? Comey and McCabe offered conflicting testimony before Congress. Rosenstein and McCabe are offering conflicting views on this counter-intel fifth column action inside Justice against President Trump. Who to believe, if any of them? For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by David Harsanyi, senior editor at TheFederalist.com, author of the book First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun, from the Revolution to Today. David, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So what about the latest, greatest former FBI guy who becomes a media star for at least a week, Andy McCabe?
I laugh out loud every time I hear him or read that he said that he set this all up so that it wouldn't just vanish into the wind. Into the Russian investigation was just going to vanish into the wind without his hard work. Whether you like Trump or you don't like Trump, the idea that a bunch of law enforcement officials, who are essentially his subordinates in a way, can basically try to set him up to overthrow the elected president. It's just, to me, this is huge, and it's never going to be treated as the big story it is because we're busy talking about whatever, you know, new serious come up about Trump conspiring with the Russians to win the election.
Yeah. Well, when McCabe spoke, to me, it felt like he was acting like a victim. Did he come across the same way to you?
Yeah, I mean, he basically has a sort of Comey-like, you know, story to tell, you know, a man just doing what's best for the nation, you know, and, you know, so, yeah, so he's acting like a victim. He's a lie. I mean, I don't even know what to say about this anymore. It's kind of like if we started this story from scratch but told you first what these FBI people had done and just with counterintelligence and how the whole thing was triggered through Oppo research done by a Democratic president, you know, paid for by a Democratic presidential candidate that was partly derived from Kremlin sources, you would say this was a coup. I hate to use that word. It's not a violent coup, but it sounds like a coup to me.
Speaking of matters of constitutional import, the president, 9 a.m. this morning, expected to declare a national emergency, invoke his powers under the 1976 National Emergencies Act to gather together additional resources than are being provided by Congress in the compromise deal to do more border security funding and wall building, ostensibly. What do you think about the argument that is being made by some conservatives that this is a dangerous precedent the president is setting?
Yeah, I think it's a very dangerous precedent. It's Obama-esque in scope, I guess, and it, you know, it's essentially going around the will of Congress. Congress just threw a budget bill that gave him some money for the wall. They obviously don't want to give him all the money for the wall. I disagree with them, but that, you know, if we're just going to find loopholes and ways to do whatever we want when we're president, that to me is executive abuse, even if he gets away with it, even if it's legal. Obama did many things through these sorts of loopholes in different ways, including DACA and many, many other things that were, in my estimation, executive abuse. And Trump needs to just find a different way and win more seats and get his wall that way. I just think this sets up a terrible precedent. And listen, Democrats might do it anyway in the future. The only silver lining might be that the court finds the 1976 law, somehow unconstitutional. And then that would be, I think, a great thing, because this is really a congressional problem. They've been handing over their duties to the executive branch for decades already. And I think that's a big problem.
And specifically, since you've written a book about America's enduring history with the gun, Pelosi invoking essentially gun control as a national emergency issue, and that the president is opening the door to this. And my point, as you sort of intimated, is, I mean, seriously, with the Democrats, how the Democrat Socialists are constituted these days with their presidential candidates, you think that they wouldn't go after guns or anything else within their left-wing agenda, regardless of what the president does or doesn't do on national emergencies as it pertains to the border?
I do, but there are two things there. I think you're making a case to the American people that it's wrong, and so that they might not do it because of political pressure. But if you're yourself doing it, then that political pressure is going to be difficult to put on them, because you yourself have done things like that. Secondly, I don't think that guns are actually anything. This is about funding and moving around money. I'm not sure. And guns are protected by the Second Amendment, obviously. I don't think that, you know, I think she's just throwing that out there as sort of scaremongering. But when you're talking about things like, you know, the Green New Deal and you know, funding certain sorts of things that, you know, that might happen. I think they would do it anyway. I think they have done things like this. They were funding Obamacare subsidies without any congressional funding mechanism. So it's not like they won't do this. If they will. But I think it's going to be harder and harder to make the case that they're abusing power if you yourself are doing the same thing.
Well, do you know the statistics of, you know, all the people that come here illegally, who commit crimes, who commit homicides, who commit rapes, and you really don't think there's any need for a national emergency to get funding for his wall?
I think that the president, I think that Congress should be working on legislation to build a wall. So I agree with you that there is an emergency there. The national emergency has never, that I have looked through them, never been used to circumvent what Congress is doing. Just because there's a problem doesn't always mean it's an emergency. I mean, using that example, liberals can easily say climate change is a huge emergency and do whatever they like when it comes to funding. I just think it's just not how the American government's supposed to work. I'm not saying, I think Trump actually has a better sort of, you know, in a broader sense, I think Trump's case is wrong. I think it's overreach, executive overreach. I mean, but he probably has a better case that the border is a much more significant national emergency than climate change and things like that. But the problem is, I'm not sure Americans are going to agree with that in the long run.
Now, the flip side of this, and we were just talking to Mark Morgan at the top of the hour, Obama's former Customs and Border Protection chief. And he suggests the president should veto the legislation that was sent to him. Some others are suggesting that, too, because there are those landmines in there that the president expressed concerns about finding when it comes to sort of new amnesties and the inability of ICE to do, you know, putting handcuffs on ICE effectively to do its job. So some real concerns there that it actually could exacerbate the problems, particularly for law enforcement. What's your view on the deal that is in place, the legislative deal in place?
I think they just tried to find something, you know, some middle ground that allowed the president to say he was moving forward and allowed, Democrats to say they had won. I don't think it seems like a good deal to me. I'm not an expert on it. I wish the president would veto it or would not have supported it and continued moving forward. I mean, I think that the shutdown did not work out for him, obviously. He doesn't have a lot of leverage. But I'm not sure that simply because a poll says that the president, you know, the people blame the Republican, which is always the case during a shutdown, doesn't mean that it's good for Democrats either. I forgot what the number was. It 1.3 billion for the wall or something.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
That's a joke. That's a joke. So he should have stuck to his guns, I think. I mean, it is ridiculous that Democrats who want to spend trillions of dollars, a bazillion dollars on Green New Deals, won't, you know, cough up a few, you know, $1 billion for a wall. It's kind of ridiculous, and I think he should just continue that fight instead of doing this. And by the way, there might be even other ways he can move forward on this incrementally rather than, rather than a national emergency.
Yeah, some discussion about working with friendly state administrations like Abbott in Texas and do a bit of a federalist play rather than the national emergency play.
And another component to this is some judge in Hawaii or somewhere else is going to step in anyway, and it's just going to be caught up in the courts and make it even more difficult to move forward, I think.
He is David Harsanyi, senior editor of Federalist.com. The book, First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun, From the Revolution to Today. David, thanks for joining us. As always, appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Excited about this $15 minimum wage coming to Illinois.
Yay! Mm-hmm. Go Illinois!
$15 minimum wage. You know the funny thing about the $15 minimum wage?
It's going to be gradual, though. It's not going to be at once, okay, guys?
Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about that, and I know that the political ruling class doesn't care about anything outside Chicago Metro. I get that. But the problem with the $15 minimum wage, I mean, so many problems, bad economics. In a lot of counties in this state, the $15 minimum wage is higher than the median household income.
Right.
So you're essentially mandating universal basic income to be provided by an employer. You know what the employer is going to do? Not do that.
Right.
And not open here. And not expand here. And not stay here.
Or, and if they are here, pass the costs on to the customers.
Reduce their overhead as it pertains to labor.
Yeah.
That's what actually happens. And, of course, who's hurt the worst? The people they say they're helping the most. Those on the lower rungs of the economic, socioeconomic ladder who are working, and good for them, to work their way up. I mean, it's so disingenuous. All of the economic arguments are specious, as any Econ 101 student or anybody who's passed an Econ 101 course will tell you. So again, these are the big ideas for the worst governed state in the history of America. Abortion, legalizing dope, and the highest minimum wage in the Midwest. This is going to go very well.
We keep going.
This is going to go very well. And people are going to keep going, as in they are
leaving.
Going to, the mass exodus from Illinois will continue, and it's going to pick up in pace. And we'll see, too. I think one of the other things that is an underreported story and working on in the newspapers that I'm a part of, a lot of people that are high profile who are quietly no longer Illinois residents, who weigh in on public policy discussions, support raising taxes, and they're not here anymore, not officially. So, yes, yeah, stand by for that.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Ocasio-Cortez, AOConomics.
Her big victory yesterday. She stopped 25,000 jobs from coming to Queens.
She's claiming credit. She really doesn't deserve it, but she's happy about it.
We were subsidizing those jobs. So for the city was paying for those jobs. So frankly, if we were willing to give Amazon willing to give away $3 billion for this deal, we could invest those $3 billion in our district ourselves if we wanted to. We could hire out more teachers. We can fix our subways. We can put a lot of people to work for that money if we wanted to.
So I'm against subsidizing private employment because I want to use that to subsidize public sector employment.
Exactly.
Got it.
There.
And also, per the GND, AOC's GND, I would also like to use some of that to subsidize people who aren't interested in private or public employment.
Exactly. Mayor Bill de Blasio, this all came as a big surprise for him.
Instead of an actual dialogue to try and resolve those issues, we get a call this morning saying we're taking our ball and we're going home. I've never seen anything like it.
Well, I doubt he was surprised, and I know they're not friends, but he could have called Governor Cuomo because Cuomo was meeting with Amazon execs along with labor unions this week, reports the New York Daily News, to salvage the deal. But when Amazon refused to relent on its opposition to unions being formed among its employees, it put Cuomo and other pro-union politicians in a bit of a tricky spot. That would, of course, include the Sandinista and de Blasio. And so you're going to stick us up on the union issue, then we're not going to break ground here. And that's how it went down.
Instead, more jobs are going to go to Nashville and to Northern Virginia. They're just going to expand those plants.
For more on AOConomics and matters at the border, we're pleased to be joined by Steve Cortez, CNN political commentator, former head of Trump's Hispanic Advisory Council. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for having me.
What about that? I mean, Chicago was in the running. We got down on bended knee again when this news came out, did Tiny Dancer and other polls to say, hey, we're still here. Come on over to Chicago. Not going to happen. But AOConomics and the Amazon sweepstakes.
Right. My long-lost cousin Cortez, she and I might share a name, but
yes.
Not much else, right?
Yes.
You know, listen, this is one of those situations, though, where I have to tell you, Dan, I really kind of root against everyone.
Right.
Governor Cuomo, Mayor de Blasio, AOC, and Amazon,
yeah.
For that matter.
Right.
I'm not going to, for one second, praise Amazon. I think big tech has been very destructive in a lot of ways for America. And I think that they're rent-seeking, and I hate the way that Amazon, I think, abused their power and got a lot of states and localities to do ridiculous bidding to try to attract them. I think that's exactly what's wrong with crony capitalism. That big business can get breaks that no small or medium-sized business could ever get. So I do hate that as a policy. Now, having said that, AOC is completely wrong. I think in her thinking, she actually thinks that the state and city of New York have $3 billion sitting in a bank account
yeah.
that they were going to hand to Amazon.
Right.
That is not the case. They were giving them $3 billion of discounts, essentially, off of taxes. And again, I don't like this. I think it's totally unfair to small business in America. But they were giving, effectively, they were handing coupons, more or less, right, to Amazon. It's not as though that money is sitting somewhere and can then be deployed elsewhere. And on top of it, as you mentioned, the idea that public sector jobs are somehow preferable to private sector jobs is just on its face, you know, a ludicrous notion, because the exact opposite, of course, is true. Government never creates prosperity. It can only create employment, for example, by taking money from the private sector or borrowing from the private sector and creating a public sector job. Government instead should be all about creating the conditions for private sector prosperity. And that's something that's not being done in New York. It's certainly not being done in Illinois either. And we see people and companies voting with their feet and places, you know, Amy, you mentioned places like Nashville, lo and behold, red states doing incredibly well and seeing nothing but growth in both population and in enterprise.
And then with Trump's new, I mean, I just did my taxes and blue states, we're getting hit hard. I mean,
right.
If you're middle income, and you own a home, you're not going to be getting a return. You're going to be having to pay cash. And it's the same with New York and with California, correct?
Right. No, and, you know, I have to say, too, though, to me, listen, I don't like it as an Illinois resident, obviously. But I have to say, too, that the complaining that is coming out of the high-tax states, out of New York, New Jersey, California, Illinois, from politicians is really, to me, you know, crocodile tears. I mean, rather than complaining that the deductibility is being limited, how about get your tax structure in line so that you're more competitive with Texas and Florida and Tennessee and all of these states that are thriving? I mean, how about take a lesson out of their playbook rather than just complaining to the federal government? And by the way, particularly in regards to the property tax deduction, I have to say that is one deduction. In general, I love tax deductions, right? The fewer taxes Americans pay, the better in general, philosophically, from my perspective. But that was a clear giveaway to the wealthiest Americans because middle-income people, for instance, who rent, get no deduction, zero. And then somebody who has a mansion in Beverly Hills gets a massive deduction off of federal taxes. So I do think that that is something that, that shouldn't be, to me, local property taxes shouldn't be a federal issue. And if local property taxes are too high, and they are in a lot of places, especially
but
here,
what about,
it's up to local politicians to fix it.
But what about writing off business expenses? I mean, you have somebody who cuts hair and she buys scissors. She can't write that off as a business expense. That's not even on the form this year.
Right. No, listen, business, I agree. Business expenses should be fully deductible for every taxpayer. And look, our tax code, even though I think it got a lot better under President Trump, it's still far from great. Our tax code is still punitive to small business in many ways. It still rewards big business. And that's not just my opinion. Just look at the tax bills that are actually paid by big business. Even when they post record profits, oftentimes the tax bill is either zero or it's close to zero. They'll be paying a percentage that is in the single digits. That's why, one reason why I think it was so important for us to get the corporate rate down, you know, I almost don't like to call it the corporate rate. I'd rather call it the small business rate, because big corporations have never paid that rate anyway. But small business does, and medium-sized business. That's why to get that rate down, as happened in the previous tax code, was so important. And it's one of the reasons that small business has been thriving under President Trump, is the incentives have been normalized, I would say, for them, particularly in regards of small business versus big business.
9 o'clock this morning, President Trump in the Rose Garden, and by the way, you can hear his remarks on our airwaves live 9 o'clock. He is going to reportedly announce he's signing the deal that Congress sent to him, and he is also declaring a national emergency to secure other funding for the border security that he wants and Congress won't give him. You tweeted out that you think he's making a mistake in signing the deal Congress sent to him, that he should veto that bill. Why?
I do. I think it's a huge mistake. The biggest reason is, and by the way, I don't want the government to be closed. I would, if I were in his shoes, and this is what I'd advise the White House, ask for a continuing resolution so we can continue to negotiate, keep the government open for a few weeks. But the biggest problem is there's a lot of embedded amnesty within this bill. And the worst version of it, there's several, but the worst version is the UAC portion, unaccompanied alien children. So young people who show up here without their parents. And they can be as old as 17, by the way. A lot of these are not children, but they're legal children. This new bill states that anyone who sponsors or may potentially sponsor, believe it or not, that's the language, a UAC cannot be deported. In addition to that, anyone who shares a household with a UAC, with an unaccompanied alien child, cannot be deported. So, number one, that is, you're automatically putting literally hundreds of thousands, perhaps even millions of people into a non-deportable category, illegal immigrants. I think that's totally wrong on its face. It's terrible policy. But in addition to that, you're encouraging the trafficking of kids, because kids become then a chip that illegal immigrants can play effectively to make sure that they're untouchable by ICE. And I specifically talked to ICE, a lot of people who, you know, didn't want to go on the record, of course, for understandable reasons, but I talked to them yesterday, and they're apoplectic over this. They just can't believe, particularly the part about may potentially sponsor a UAC. How is ICE supposed to determine who's a potential sponsor? How are they supposed to determine who actually lives in a household or not? You're asking ICE agents to suddenly become basically judges out there. You're completely handcuffing them instead of allowing them to handcuff the bad guys. And so to me, this is an amnesty that is totally unacceptable. It's inconsistent with the entire 2016 movement. And I don't think it's going to happen, unfortunately. It looks like the president's signing this, you know, within minutes. But I'm one of his strongest supporters, and yet I'm being incredibly critical of him on this. This is a major failure. He's being played by the Hill, both Republicans and Democrats, by Speaker Pelosi most of all. He needs to veto this legislation and say, give us a CR, and I will negotiate with you, rather than relying on the feckless Senate Republicans who clearly didn't do their job, that they allowed this ridiculous provision to get into this bill.
So what should he do? You think he should just declare the national emergency and just go around Congress?
I do. I mean, and by the way, too, it's not going around Congress. Congress itself gave him this authorization.
Right, 76 law. Right.
Right. And by the way, I think it's a bad law. I said this last night on CNN. I think it's too expansive. I think it gives the executive too much power, quite frankly. But the Congress did it. So the idea that he's going around Congress is absurd. Congress specifically gave him this authorization. And it has been used for things as absurd as unrest in Burundi. President Obama declared a U.S. national emergency because of of unrest in Burundi, a place that few Americans could even find on a map. So if unrest in Central Africa is a national emergency for the United States, then clearly a crisis, and it is a crisis, at our own southern border is a national emergency for the United States. Again, I don't love this law philosophically, but it is the law, and it has been for almost 50 years. And given that it is, he clearly has, in my view, the authorization to do this. So, yes, what I think he should do, yes to the emergency, no to this ridiculous bill. I don't want to play shutdown brinksmanship, though. Tell the Congress, pass a CR. And if they don't, and they may not, then at least that shutdown is on Nancy Pelosi, unlike the last one. This one would clearly be in their laps because the president is saying, I want the government open while we continue to negotiate and get these amnesties out of this bill. We did not run an amnesty, Dan. I mean, Amy, this is not what we ran on in 2016. It's the antithesis of what we ran on. And so I'm really imploring the White House and President's supporters to get loud about this. And if he does sign it, we have to try to undo it as quickly as we possibly can.
He is Steve Cortez, CNN political commentator and former head of Trump's Hispanic Advisory Council. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
You bet. Have a great day.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer.
Dan and Amy, we talked about this story earlier in the week. Finally made its way around from a November PGA tournament, the Mayakoba Golf Classic down in Playa del Carmen.
Played
that course. Matt Kuchar. His regular tour caddy was unavailable, I think, under the weather. So he got a local caddy, a guy they call El Toucan.
Yeah, that's his nickname, right?
The Toucan.
Yeah, the Toucan.
Mm-hmm.
Matt Kuchar. Public enemy number one, but go on.
Kuchar wins the tournament.
Yeah, this story is unbelievable.
$1.296 million for first prize. So $1.3 million he wins. And he pays the Toucan $5,000.
Which is a joke because he should have gotten 10%, $130,000.
That's sort of standard on the tour. The Toucan contacted Kuchar's agent and said, hey, you know, I don't want to put Matt in a bad light, but how about, you know, a little something extra for the effort? And he said, well, there's no money, but when you die, you'll receive total consciousness. No, he didn't say that. He did say that what Kuchar gave him is fair. Kuchar, then seeming to realize the error of his ways, offered Toucan an additional $15,000. But Toucan basically said, you know, I don't want your, you know, payoff money. I want what I should have got, which is...
Won the 130, or at least 125, or at least 100,000.
So...
I mean, Matt Kuchar, he's earned more than $45 million as a professional golfer.
Yeah, and then $1.3 million purse, this tournament. What would you have paid your regular tour caddy?
Well, and he paid the caddy the flat rate, which is $1,500. But plus some, you know, $5,000.
He said, Kuchar saying that the $5,000 was a good deal for Toucan because it's actually $1,000 more than they agreed upon. They agreed upon $4,000, $1,000 a day for the 4 days. I ended up paying him $5,000, and I thought that was more than what we agreed upon, Kuchar said. I kind of think if he had the chance to do it over again, same exact deal, that he'd say yes again. I feel like I was fair and good. You can't make everybody happy. You're not going to buy people's ability to be okay with you. And this seems to be a social media issue more than anything. I think it shouldn't be, knowing that there was a complete agreed-upon deal that not only did I meet, but I exceeded. So I certainly didn't lose sleep over this. This is something that I'm quite happy with, and I was really happy for him to have a great week and make a good sum of money. Making $5,000 is a great week. Not as great as making $130,000.
No.
Not as great as making $1.3 million. But here's the thing.
Yeah, so what's the...
I get it, if that's right. So Kuchar, if I'll pay $1,000 a month to carry my bag. You're not my regular caddy. You're not a tour caddy, so I'm not going to pay the same rate. But here's... I mean, come on.
They'd never worked together before. I mean, this is such a great story, and then he ruins it by being a pippin.
Well, right. The thing is, you know what the prevailing rate is. You won the tournament with this guy in your bag. So you don't want to give him the full 10% that you give your normal guy. But really, whether you agreed upon it or not, because you're just so excited to caddy in the tournament, and $5,000 for a weekend is a lot of money, particularly down in Mexico. But you had an opportunity to do something that would be life-changing for this guy who carried your bag and was part of winning the tournament. and it doesn't mean anything to you. Give him 50 grand. You know what that meant to Matt Kuchar? 50 grand means to Matt Kuchar? Nothing. No. Give him 100 grand or give him the 130 that you would have given your tour caddy. It's just poor form. And since golf is a gentleman's game, I don't think Matt Kuchar is being a gentleman here.
Just so you know, a GoFundMe account has been set up by some fans that are clearly disagree with Matt Kuchar. Their goal is to raise $50,000. Right now, it's at $2,226.
You'll probably raise more than Matt Kuchar paid out.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Jussie Smollett, his story seems to be deteriorating rather than being strengthened after his very soft Good Morning America interview with Robin Roberts yesterday. ABC and CBS reporting here locally that their multiple sources suggest that the attack on Smollett was staged and that it was staged because he was being written out of the show. Now, to be fair, the Empire denies that he was being written out of the show, number one. And then number two, Chicago police say they're still treating him as a victim. They have two persons of interest, the two silhouettes that we've seen in the video that have been detained for questioning, their apartment searched.
Yeah, they live in Lakeview, and the store where they bought the clothing line, the Ace Hardware there in Wrigleyville, police have been to that shop. Also, these two brothers, one worked as an extra on Empire, and they're both from Nigeria. So within hours after the purported attack, Dan, they go to O'Hare, jump on a plane for Nigeria. They come back Wednesday. They're immediately taken in for questioning. They've been there almost for 48 hours, so they have to charge them or release them by 5:45 p.m. tonight.
Now, Smollett suggests that the two people on the video were the people that attacked him. And the two people on the video are these Nigerian brothers who were tracked down by police, apparently, by looking at rideshare receipts.
Yep, they took rideshare receipts from that area. They checked out, and it led them to their apartment in Wrigleyville.
And let me just say, and I've tweeted it out, Jussie Smollett's story that one of these two punched him, and then he punched that guy back, and then the other guy kicked him, and then for some unknown reason, they decided to scurry away.
Oh, but they poured bleach on him first and said, this is MAGA country.
If you see these two,
they're huge.
Let me just say something. If one of them, either one of them, had punched Jussie Smollett, we would be memorializing Jussie Smollett as an actor cut down in the prime of his career. That's what would have actually happened.
They're both up. Gub received scholarships for football, okay? They're big dudes.
For more on this and a couple other topics, including the Gosnell movie, which both Amy and I have finally gotten around to seeing, we're pleased to be joined again by Andrew Klavan, podcaster, Another Kingdom is his podcast. It's at season two. A screenwriter, Hollywood screenwriter, a number of films, including, of course, the Gosnell movie. Andrew, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks.
So what about Jussie Smollett? I don't know if you had the time to get out and march with all the Hollywood celebrities in solidarity with him a couple weekends ago, but it doesn't look like that march is going to wear well.
It's funny. First of all, the first thing that really strikes me about the story is how professional the Chicago PD has been. They sound like they're doing a very careful, very professional job, and I think that's to their credit. You know, when this story broke, I have to tell you, the first season of Empire is one of the very, very few shows I've ever binged. I found it to be incredibly gripping and entertaining. I couldn't stop. I think I almost never watch more than an hour of TV on any given day. I think I watched five episodes in a row. I found it so addictive. And Smollett was one of the high points of the show, an amazingly talented, very appealing guy with a good storyline about a gay guy with a black homophobic father. I mean, just very, very powerful TV stuff. So I was a big fan, you know, and the minute I heard the story, I said, this isn't tracking for me. And I didn't want to disbelieve him. I don't want to disbelieve him now, you know. But it does sound that this is unraveling. And if I, who does a podcast, you know, if I, a podcaster, had enough
a wit to doubt the story. Why didn't anybody in the press ask questions?
Well, they did. I mean, locally, on a national level, like all your Access Hollywood and all those guys.
No,
they were treating him as a victim.
Locally, they were on his side from the beginning. They didn't question it locally. This was Covington all over again.
And the national press was just embarrassing. I mean, it was just so credulous and so, you know, I mean, again, all I ask is that just a little bit of doubt, you know, it's like when you read a quote by George Washington that confirms all your political beliefs, I immediately check it out. I immediately assume that it's a fake quote because George Washington wasn't, you know, a 21st century right winger. He was who he was, you know.
Right.
And so when I hear a story like this and it just fits so easily into the left wing narrative of what America is like and includes guys walking around it's like 20 below out there.
It was minus 23 degree wind chill that night.
Yeah, you know, wandering around looking for star trouble. It just didn't scan from the very start, and now it does seem like it's unraveling. Some of it is suspicious. Look, I'm perfectly willing to withhold judgment, but it's hard to withhold judgment on the press. I mean, it just seems to me that a press that just reports every story like this is just revealing about themselves what they think about America. You know, I'm a fiction writer all my life, and what I always say is fiction is a method of revealing the truth, but fantasy only reveals the truth about the person telling the story. And what this reveals about our press and maybe about Jesse Smollett is their sense of this country as a dangerous, hateful place. I mean, the story could have happened because, of course, there are dangerous, hateful people everywhere. But this country is not the kind of place where people go around getting attacked like this. It doesn't. When it happens, it makes news because it's so rare. It is so rare. And I mean, this is a country that has dealt with its racist past, has really experienced shame and a turning of the heart. And yet the left just cannot accept it. They really do believe, you know, Michelle Obama really believed that Barack Obama at any minute was going to get killed if he pumped gas at a gas station. She really believed that. This is the story they tell themselves. And they ought to open their eyes and talk to some actual Americans and find out how people feel, because this is one of the most generous, open countries on earth. And it is, and I lived overseas for 7 years, it is the least racist country on the planet. Mm-hmm. And so what bothers me about this is the accepting of the story without questioning it, and the using of the story as if it were representative of America, of the American atmosphere.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, the other thing, though, is on Smollett, the cynicism. What did he know? If assuming that this is embellished at the least or made up completely at the worst, what did he know? He knew that the narrative of the victim hero will be taken without hesitation by the press corps.
That's right. That's right. And what, you know, what a sad thing it is. Here's this guy who's at the top, you know, he's one of the top people. He's working in Hollywood. He's got a great hit show. What a terrible, sad thing to feel that he has to increase his visibility by treating himself as a victim. I mean, so many people of all different colors who are successful in athletics or in show business go out and serve charities and sit with sick children and, you know, front for good causes. He is going to establish his, you know, bona fides by getting himself attacked. I mean, what a sad way to use your celebrity. I mean, what a pitiful thing, really, to do if that's what it turns out to be. I mean, the whole idea, and these, so many of these hate crimes are faked today, you know, on college campuses. So many are revealed to be fake. What a terrible thing it says about the mindset of people, that they feel that this somehow elevates them to be a victim. You know, I mean, I think being a hero elevates you. I think being a good person elevates you. I think being a victim is just a sad thing that happens to some people, and it's awful, but it's not something I'd audition for.
I wanted to switch gears. Both Amy and I have had a chance now to see the Gosnell movie. We've talked about it before with you, but we hadn't seen it when we did. And boy, was that well done! It exceeded my expectations. And there were some, and I would just want to talk about a couple of choices you made. I don't want to do too much in terms of spoiler alert here, but you and everybody associated with it, and the acting,
the acting was amazing.
The guy who played Earl Billings, his name I think, who played Gosnell, was
good.
Oh man,
he was amazing.
Yeah.
Like, he had his mannerisms down, and he nailed his character.
He was perfect. I mean, it's tough to play a sociopath that well, and boy, he did.
Yeah.
But the choice to not disclose graphic images. And the way that it was presented during the trial of Gosnell, I thought was probably more powerful than if you had presented the graphic pictures. But that and then so that was one moment. And the other moment for me was Jeanine Turner on the witness stand as the responsible operator of an abortion clinic to distinguish herself from the irresponsible in Gosnell, and the presentation of her essentially through cross-examination as no different than Gosnell. I thought those were like two real inflection points in the film.
Well, thanks. I mean, the first one was something that everybody agreed on from the very beginning. You know, I always remind people that the arts are something people do in their spare time. Nobody wants to go out to a movie and watch, you know, babies being ripped to shreds. We wanted to talk about the personal drama. We wanted to talk about the human drama, and everyone was on board with that from the very beginning. That scene that you're talking about, I wish I could say, oh, I made that brilliant scene up, but I took it right out of the transcripts. Yeah. I mean, obviously I had to edit it for space and, you know, condense it into a into screenplay form, but that actually happened in the trial. As so much of the stuff that happens, none of this is made up. So much of it comes right out of the transcripts. And it is an amazing moment, because one of the things that I kept finding, I think we all kept finding, is people didn't know. You know, they didn't know what people would say, oh, well, abortion should be legal to 20 weeks. And you start to count that on your fingers and you think, wait a minute, that's 5 months. Right. Does anybody think that a five-month-old baby in the womb is not an actual baby? I mean, that's insane. You know? So much about abortion, which people don't think about because people don't pay that much attention, is shocking when you actually confront it. And I think that that's one of the things about the movie, is it's not a story of bloodshed the way the movie is told. It's a story of moral atrocity more than physical atrocity. You know, it's what people are accepting as normal in this country right this minute that is really something I think needs to be confronted. You know, I think we're in a society right now with a couple of ideas that are actually psychopathic, and I think good people, really good people, do very bad things when the intellectual atmosphere of a country is sick. And, you know, I mean, this is the kind of thing where you find in Nazi Germany, you'll find perfectly decent people doing terrible things. Mm. In the slaveholding South, you found perfectly decent people doing things that are, we now look back and think, how could they? How could they have done it? And I really feel the country is in this state right now where if the good people would just confront what this really is, look at the science, look at the pictures, look at the way the things we now know, I think that they would just rise up in horror and say, oh, my God, what have we done, you know?
Right.
And so I don't think this is ever a matter of blaming individuals. It's a matter of looking at the society and saying, hey, you know, we went down a wrong road. When you go down a wrong road, the way forward is back. And that's just something that I think this country really needs to be talking about and thinking about, and nobody should be intimidated into silence over.
Well, the timing of this couldn't be better, for the discussion. I mean, with New York and Virginia and Rhode Island and Illinois. I mean, to have this policy discussion, say, is this the kind of civilization we want to have? I think, you know, your movie sets that discussion up perfectly.
Well, I'm happy to hear that. I mean, obviously, that's, you know, they always say God's timing is the best timing, and that's something none of us could have planned, but I guess it's kind of written into the idea. You know, it's amazing. I mean, this is one of the things that I talk about more than anything. It's amazing how bad ideas, false ideas, ideas that don't accurately describe reality, lead all of us, an entire society, into very, very dark places. And that's why it's important for people not to be silenced, and it's important for people not to be silent. You know, we all have to say, let me examine that idea for a minute. I'm not going to attack you, but let me look at your ideas here and see if they make sense, see if they actually describe reality. And I think this is one of the big mistakes that this country has made. And I think, you know, the way people look back and they blame, you know, guys like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson for holding slaves without really understanding what it's like to live in that kind of society, I think a lot of people are going to look back at us and feel the same way.
And was Gosnell that monster of a doctor? Was he really that way? I mean, I'll never forget the scene where he had blood on his lab coat and then he sits down and has takeout Chinese food.
He
liked his animals more than innocent babies that he killed.
Those depictions were taken directly from my conversations with the detective, the guy who's played by Dean Cain in the movie. And he's a great guy. And he just looks at the world and thinks, what the hell is going on here? And his description, especially, of going in to search this guy's house, where everywhere he lived was just like an absolute mess, you know, cats all over the place, leaving dirt everywhere. And when they came in to search this place, looking for evidence of very terrible crimes, Gosnell sat down and played the piano searching, which is in the movie. And, you know, he was telling me these stories with a look on his face like, you know, I have seen things that said to me, like, I have seen things that you would not believe. And that personality was really
chilling.
It was taken directly from the things that the guys were telling me.
Did you ever find out the mother of baby boy A?
Did I ever find out who it was?
I don't
believe I did. It's a while since I wrote it, but I don't believe I was trying to do that.
Well, one other thing I didn't know from the story, and I read about it at the time when the press actually started covering it, the blogger, was that real? That blogger played such an instrumental role in getting national media to pay attention to the case?
No, that was actually a condensed character.
Okay.
What really happened, I mean, the press ignored the case. It ignored the case. And finally, it was, her name just slipped out of my head, but she was a journalist for, a columnist for USA Today, very liberal columnist, finally said, hey, you're ignoring this case because it's about abortion, you know, and then people started to show up. And so she became the blogger character, and she wouldn't let us use her name, and so we condensed a few characters into the blogger character.
Just curious. All right, well, Gosnell, it's available on Amazon right now, so you can buy it or rent it, and you should do that. He is Andrew Klavan. You should also listen to his podcast, Another Kingdom. It's in season 2. Screenwriter for the Gosnell movie and many other films of yore, including True Crime. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us. As always, appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.